From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with media critic John Powers about the increasingly divisive nature of American politics and popular culture. His new book, Sore Winners, is about politics and culture during the presidency of George W. Bush. Also, we talk with photographer Mick Rock. His pictures of Deborah Harry, David Bowie, and Iggy Pop helped turn them into music icons. His new collection of photos is called Picture This, Debbie Harry and Blondie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A suicide bomber killed more than 70 people and injured dozens more today in the Iraqi town of Bakuba. The bomber detonated a minibus loaded with explosives near a police station in the town north of Baghdad. The BBC's Peter Gresta reports.
The explosive was placed and timed for maximum effect. The suicide bomber drove his vehicle into a queue of volunteers lining up outside a police station to sign on. There were so many recruits that they'd run out of space inside. And on the street, a crush of commuters, shoppers and stalls. The bomber struck just as a bus was passing. Chaos and panic followed the blast. The police fired into the air to try to restore some kind of order. The explosion littered the street with corpses. Pickup trucks ran shuttles to the overflowing hospital. The staff there were overwhelmed. Victims were lined up on the blood-soaked floor, and the morgue simply couldn't cope with the sheer number of bodies.
The BBC's Peter Gresta in Baghdad. U.S. troops and other members of the multinational force fought a series of skirmishes with insurgents in Iraq today. A Polish military spokesman said troops fought with militants who were believed to have crossed the border from Iran, killing 35 insurgents. He said seven Iraqi police officers were also killed in the action. Military officials said two coalition soldiers and two U.S. soldiers were killed in action in Anbar province. A militant group said today that it has killed two Pakistani hostages, allegedly because their country was considering sending troops to Iraq. The Democratic National Convention is meeting for a third session tonight, promoting the theme of a stronger, more secure America. The evening's highlight is expected to be the closing speech by John Edwards, the North Carolina Senator John Kerry picked as his running mate. NPR's David Wilner reports from Boston.
With U.S. troops fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Democrats are seeking to shore up their credibility on national defense tonight, at a time when polls show President Bush holding an edge on the issue over John Kerry. Today, in a move the Kerry campaign called unprecedented, a dozen retired admirals and generals publicly endorsed the Kerry-Edwards ticket. And Kerry himself arrived in Boston today for his formal nomination, joined by a dozen of his former Navy crewmates. Former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General John Shalikashvili will be addressing the convention tonight. He'll be followed on the podium by John Edwards' daughter Kate, and then his wife Elizabeth, and finally, Edwards himself. Kerry is to deliver his nomination acceptance speech tomorrow, closing the convention. David Wilner, NPR News, Boston.
In stocks, the Dow gained 32 points to close at 10,117. The Nasdaq was down 10 to close at 1,858. This is NPR News. In Mexico, a judge has halted an attempt by President Vicente Fox's administration to bring a former president of the country to trial on charges of human rights abuse. James Bleers reports from Mexico City.
Special Prosecutor Ignacio Carrillo had sought the arrest of former Mexican President Luis Echeverria on charges of genocide allegedly committed during his term as leader between 1970 and 1976. But the warrant has been thrown out by federal judge Cesar Flores, who says that these events happened more than 30 years ago and now fall outside the country's statute of limitations. In the early 1970s, Mexico's so-called dirty war saw hundreds of dissidents and activists killed, or they permanently disappeared. The special prosecutor could still appeal this judgment. For NPR News, I'm James Blears in Mexico City.
The FBI says it's investigating two suspected cases of food tampering in Orange County, California. An FBI spokeswoman said trace amounts of the poison ricin have been found in at least one jar of baby food that had been tampered with. Federal officials say the poison came from ground-up castor beans and that the amount was unlikely to cause serious injury. She said the investigation was based on complaints in late May and June from people in Irvine, California, who said they found notes in baby food warning that it had been contaminated. She said the food was Gerber banana yogurt and that both jars were brought from the same store. A spokeswoman for Gerber said authorities told the company that the contamination occurred after the food was manufactured. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop introduces the limited edition NPR Tivoli Model 1 radio, designed by Henry Kloss for both performance and simplicity. Available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air critic at large, John Powers, has written a new book about our increasingly polarized culture. The book focuses on the years of the George W. Bush presidency. John covers what he describes as the artificiality of our political discourse, the shrieking of our pop culture, and the babble of information that bombards us every day. The book is called Sore Winners. John writes a weekly column on media and culture for LA Weekly. In September, he'll return to his position as film critic for Vogue. Do you think that politics have become part of popular culture? Like, there used to be this big, you know, delineation between politics and pop culture. Do you think more and more politics crosses into the territory of pop culture?
No, I think actually that's one of the great transformations of my life, is that I think when I was growing up, you actually had the political figures in Washington, D.C., and they were making their decisions. And then you had Elvis in popular culture or the Beatles in popular culture. Over the last 40 years, what's happened is that the two have begun to mesh. And so what's fascinating about it is that simultaneously, popular culture carries more obvious political meanings. And actually, popular culture becomes a way that people talk about politics. And at the same time, political figures become more like pop culture figures, so that Donald Rumsfeld isn't simply the Secretary of Defense. He's this great performer.
So do you think now that politics has kind of crossed over into the world of pop culture, that the value of politicians is measured in part by their value as celebrities?
Oh, yes. I think if you actually look at the complaints that people make about John Kerry, you know, there are the political complaints about him being a flip-flopper and so forth. But there's also the complaint that basically he's not an exciting, fun, entertaining guy. If you watched Bill Clinton the other night, you realize that, oh, that here is a guy who is, above all, a star. You know, he actually has all sorts of political virtues, but he also has the charisma that makes him a celebrity and makes people want to see him. And that's truer and truer than ever. And I think that as people's experience of politics comes more and more through media outlets rather than through the daily life of actually being active in politics in their own community, that's going to be truer and truer. That you actually have to be a good showman, I think, to really get ahead, or at least you have to have people who put on a good show around you. I think probably the interesting thing about George Bush is that he's the latter, whereas Clinton was himself the show. I think what George Bush has done is to make himself sort of the anti-show. He's the straightforward, regular guy who, in fact, doesn't present himself as a show. But then he has people around him like his advisor, Karl Rove, who know how to present that regular guy image in the best possible way.
Now, you've pointed out in a recent column that presidential campaigns have come to take on narratives as if they were Hollywood films. What's an example of that?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, if you look back at the 2000 campaign, when Al Gore ran against George Bush, what was fascinating was that early on, that somehow it was decided, and it's never clear who quite decided it, but it became the conventional wisdom that George Bush was a good regular guy who wasn't so smart, and that Al Gore was kind of a priggish guy who was smart but also a liar. And no matter what happened during the course of that election, did either of those guys ever quite escape that particular perception? So that anything that Al Gore said that seemed the slightest bit suspicious was used as evidence of the fact that he's not honest. Whereas every time George Bush stumbled over a word, that was taken as further proof that he doesn't know anything. For me, the irony of that was that if you actually look back at that election, the person who ran the dumb campaign and who was dumb during that election was Al Gore. And the person who I think was was actually not, who didn't present himself quite as honestly, is George W. Bush. You know, that the, and so for me, the funny thing is that probably there was a flip-flop in relation to what the actual narrative was, as opposed to the official narrative that was presented by the media.
In what way do you think Al Gore was dumb, and in what way do you think George W. Bush was dishonest?
Yes. Well, Al Gore was dumb in a variety of ways. I think one of the major ways he was dumb was that he didn't realize, one, that you actually have to get along with the media. He was actually very, very distant and detached from the media. The second thing was he ran away from the Clinton legacy. There's a remarkable moment in Joe Klein's book on Clinton where a member of the Bush family says, you know, that they could never understand why Gore didn't turn to Bush in one of the debates and say to Bush, "George, what exactly is it you don't like about peace and prosperity?" But in fact, Gore was so busy making himself his own man that, in fact, he detached himself from what was clearly the most winning thing that he had going for him, being part of what most Americans thought of as a successful administration. The Bush case is slightly different because Bush, for much of his life, had been presented as a centrist, and in fact, in Texas had governed as a centrist. But as we've seen over the last few years, that I think no one, either on left or right, would say that George Bush is a centrist figure. In fact, he's very much a man of the right. But in presenting himself as a compassionate conservative, he was clearly doing the triangulation thing that Clinton himself had done in the previous elections, which is to say, you try to stake out the center by taking over many of the issues that belong to the other party and trying to suggest that you are that centrist figure. In fact, George Bush is not a centrist figure. In fact, you know, Al Gore was dumb during that election.
How do you think the narrative of the George W. Bush story has changed in the past 4 years? When he was running for the presidency the first time, he was, for a lot of people, the guy you wanted to have a beer with, you know, a regular guy. But he's been the president for nearly 4 years, so his regular guy-ness has probably diminished by virtue of having been the president for several years now. So do you think the story's changed?
Yeah, the story's changed several times. I mean, you know, one of the fascinating things about any presidency, and, you know, the Bush presidency is no different, is that we get various myths built up around the president. At different points, the media decides that this is how we're going to present the guy. You know, at one point, he was dumb. At another point, he's a regular guy. At another point, he was the CEO president. You know, that one didn't last very long. But, you know, if there was a time when you kept hearing, you know, he went to Harvard Business School. The big transformation in Bush's presidency came with 9/11, where he went from a guy who was basically considered someone who was sort of an ordinary, regular guy on the right to a wartime leader. And in the book, I write about the Prince Hal scenario, which is very much, you know, based on Shakespeare's Henry plays, about the young wastrel guy who isn't doing very much, but who then, because history demands it of him, rises to the occasion. And if you look in the months after 9/11, there are dozens, perhaps hundreds of cases where important journalists would make reference to George Bush being like Prince Hal in the Shakespeare play, a guy who was underestimated, or as he liked to put it, misunderestimated, but who then came through on the big occasion to fight this epic battle. The one that followed that was the negative one, which I call in the book the transformation of Bush into Moby W., because among the people who dislike him, he became a figure that transcended politics, became an almost metaphysical figure, the white whale that Ahab is chasing. You know, that it's one of the striking features of the Bush years is that the level of polarization is so hysterical. So that, you know, I know a lot of people who don't just think that they dislike George Bush, or that even that he's a bad president, they think he has to be the worst president in the history of the country, and he's a genuinely evil man. You know, this didn't just start with Bush. It was also true of the Clinton years.
Now, John, this book is about popular culture and the media during the Bush administration. Do you think that pop culture is affected by who's in the White House?
Yes. I think pop culture is partly affected by who's in the White House, but I think that what's more important is the way that we think of pop culture, depending on who's in the White House. You know, and it's an important distinction to draw, because really most presidential figures, you know, don't have that much interest in popular culture. George W. Bush certainly doesn't. And one of my favorite stories about him on the campaign trail in the year 2000 was when somebody asked him about the show Sex and the City, and he got mad because he thought the person was prying into his personal life. you know, that Bush is not very interested in popular culture. But we tend to read the tone and feeling of the country through the presidency. And that mean, and that therefore we start interpreting the pop culture through the feeling that we, of the politics. And in fact, then the pop culture starts reflecting on the political figures as well. And I think that's precisely what's happened during the Bush years, is that you see shows that clearly George W. Bush didn't create. They weren't created in response to him. But somehow some of those shows seem more or less metaphorically apt. They actually resonate in a different way.
What are some of the shows that fit that?
Yes. Well, I think that I think one of the defining features of our time is what I call, you know, populist social Darwinism, which is to say that we're obsessed with the idea of winners and losers. And in fact, that one of the part of the genuine feel of the Bush years are all these reality game shows like Survivor, like American Idol, and like The Apprentice, which are basically all about this creating this group of people who are clearly winners, and then other groups of people being treated as if they were losers. And I think that is one of the defining ideological features of our society at the moment, which probably contributed perhaps to Bush's winning. Certainly, you know, American Idol or Survivor weren't created by George W. Bush, but they seem particularly resonant at the moment.
How do you think winners and losers, in a larger way, is fitting into American culture now?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, every culture always has people who triumph and you know, are successful. But I think we live at one of those moments in history where the gap between the people at the top and the rest of us seems larger than ever. And it's not simply a question of money. It's a question of it's a question of power. It's a question of fame. If you live now and live in our media culture, you're bombarded 24 hours a day by stories about people who are successful businessmen, who are political figures, who are world famous stars. That in fact, you sense that there's this huge world out there of winners. And in fact, that makes the rest of us feel like losers. The interesting thing about this particular moment is that even though we've always had winners and people who feel like losers, the winners now are so obnoxious. You know, that Americans used to be thought of as really good winners. But in fact, we now live at a point where actually people, you know, aren't such good winners. You know, whether it's Donald Trump, you know, making it with the tagline, "You're fired," or whether it's, you know, the young high school athlete LeBron James turning up at high school in his brand new $40,000 car, you know, even though he's still another high school student, or Bill O'Reilly telling you how many books he's sold, or Donald Rumsfeld, you know, basically dressing down reporters asking him questions as if they were no smarter than oysters. The official style of winners these days is to be kind of a sore winner. They're not gracious. That in fact, they actually suggest that they should be winning, and if you question that, there's something wrong with you.
My guest is Fresh Air critic at large, John Powers. His new book, Sore Winners, is about the intersection of politics and pop culture during the Bush presidency. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air critic at large, John Powers. He's written a new book about the increasingly divisive nature of politics and popular culture, focusing on the years of the Bush presidency. It's called Sore Winners. Now, you say in your book, Sore Winners, that the media has a taste for extreme positions, and you write about some of the either-ors that the media helps force people into, either-ors fueled by the media's taste for extreme positions. So, and you say these are specious either-ors. For example, you either supported invading Iraq or you were pro-Saddam. You either dislike frivolous pop culture or you lack values. Can you talk about these either-ors and what you think is presenting this kind of false dichotomy?
Yes. Well, actually, you know, that either-ors are very dramatic. You know, that if you watch watch the good talk show hosts. You know, if you take someone like Bill O'Reilly, who's a very skillful talk show host, he always poses questions as an either-or question. Because if you say, what do you think about this? Someone might give you an answer that's neither either nor or, but something in between, and there's no drama in that. So that, in fact, what you want, you know, in media coverage of things is to have a vivid position which allows people to argue clearly and vividly, because people aren't always paying full attention. So you want that excitement that comes from a head-on collision rather than a discussion of three or four or five possible points of view. If you take the example that you mentioned about either you support invading Iraq or you're objectively pro-Saddam, you know, of course at some fundamental level, that's nonsense. You know, it's simply not true that you are objectively pro-Saddam if you weren't for invading Iraq. There are many ways you could have thought of trying to bring Saddam's regime down without invading Iraq. But as we now discuss these things in politics, you actually have to be that way. You know, you can flip it, because the left is often as guilty, maybe just as often as guilty of this as the right, is that, I mean, I knew people who opposed invading Iraq who would say to me, aren't you aware that the United States helped overthrow Salvador Allende in Chile? And I would say, well, yes, I am aware of that, but that actually doesn't mean that it's wrong if you wanted to overthrow Saddam. It's not the same thing. You know, in the one case, you're overthrowing an elected official. In the other case, you're overthrowing a dictatorship. Those aren't oppositions. But we're now taught to think in terms of oppositions, and certainly the successful media shows tend to push opposition, the drama and the conflict of it.
It's also easier to get your position in a short answer, in a short soundbite, if you're seeing things in black and white.
Yes, you know, I mean, black and white is vivid. You know, and political discussions, I think, often now take the form, you know, they're kind of like movie trailers in a way. You know, there's that strange moment in the history of movie trailers where the movie trailer became so important that, in fact, movies began being shot in order to contain stuff that would look good in the trailer. Similarly, in political discussions, ideas that now come out are chosen because they will actually look good in the soundbite, or that you can actually advertise them as having something that's really exciting and hot, that has a lot of pop. You know, so that the idea that you would actually have a nuanced position on something, you know, is a term of abuse. You know, even among Democrats, you often hear people attacking John Kerry on the grounds that he's too nuanced, which, you know, in your normal life, you would probably think, you know, that's not so bad. If you think of, you know, being at your office with your boss, you know, you probably don't want a boss who sees purely things in black and white. He's either really happy with you or he hates you. You know, you might want a boss who actually thinks, well, you're doing a good job some of the time. You're not doing such a good job the other time. But in fact, we're all for you. But in the world of the media landscape, that kind of nuance is considered to be a vice. You know, it's not simply a bore. It's considered a vice.
My guest is media critic John Powers, and he has a new book called Sore Winners. Well, John, you live in Los Angeles, and you've written about movies and about actors for years. Now you have a Republican governor who is an actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, at the same time, many conservatives see Hollywood as the enemy of all the values that they hold dear. How do you reconcile that there are several actors from Hollywood who have become political leaders, including Ronald Reagan, Clint Eastwood, Arnold Schwarzenegger, even Charlton Heston, who headed the NRA. How do you reconcile that with this sense that, you know, Hollywood is the anti-value place?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, the idea of Hollywood as the anti-value place, you know, is a very complicated argument for conservatives to make, because, of course, Hollywood is also like one of the great bastions of free market capitalism. You know, and Daniel Bell, the thinker, famously wrote, you know, about the cultural contradictions of capitalism, that one of the fascinating things about the capitalist world is that many of the values that traditional conservatives would hold dear are in fact challenged by the very capitalist enterprises that they also champion. If you take someone like Rupert Murdoch as an example, you know, Rupert Murdoch is not only the man who runs Fox News or owns Fox News, he's also the person who put on The Simpsons and Married with Children and In Living Color. You know, and many of the raunchiest shows that have ever been on American TV come out of that same thing, because it's about making money. And, you know, so for conservatives, the Hollywood problem is that they actually support the money-making aspect of Hollywood. They don't like the particular products that come out. If you move to the question of why so many of the people who've made it big in politics have been conservative. I think it's because the myth-making machinery of Hollywood is particularly good in political terms at manufacturing iconic figures of authority and male power and responsibility. And if you look at the Hollywood figures who've made it big, whether it's Clint Eastwood or Ronald Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger, they tend to come across as very male, very confident. They're confident in their authority and their power. And then the Hollywood myth-making machine actually works to enhance that, to make them more powerful. And clearly that has a much greater electoral appeal than, for instance, the neurosis and passion of a James Dean or Marlon Brando. Americans are much more drawn to iconic masculinity. And in an interesting way, just in this year's presidential election, for example, you clearly see that, you know, both John Kerry and George Bush are in their ways offering different models of iconic masculinity. George Bush is the sheriff, you know, that he's the wanted dead or alive guy. He's the Texan who talks like a Texan. That's a very male authority idea. John Kerry's countering that by being basically the war hero, another source of male authority.
You know, we are told that we live in a very divided country now of red states and blue states and so on. When you live in Los Angeles, or
yes,
just outside Los Angeles. Your parents live in Des Moines.
Yes.
When you go visit them, do you feel like you're visiting a different culture? I mean, has the difference between Los Angeles and Des Moines changed at all in your mind?
No, I think there's almost no difference in some, you know, between Iowa and Los Angeles in many cultural things. You know, the great illusion of the red state, blue state idea was that somehow that if you went to Alabama, that 99% of the people voted for Bush and 1% for Gore, or if you went to California, it was the same thing. In fact, you know, that's a false idea. The truth was, you know, in the red state, blue state idea was that almost all the red and blue states were extremely close. There were some exceptions, of course. But in fact, that in Alabama, you know, there are 40% of the people who are officially blue state types. And in California, there are 40% who are red state types. You know, Iowa was an extremely close vote. And when I go to visit my folks in Iowa, I'm struck by the fact that I don't run into, you know, people who are incomprehending about what it could be like to live on the coast. You know, I don't meet people who think, you know, who only watch Fox News, which seems to be one of the great ideas that many people have, is that once you're in the red state, everybody watches Fox News. You know, you don't find that. What you find is something that is a farm state, but that in many ways resembles a lot of what I see in Los Angeles.
John Powers, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
John Powers is the author of the new book, Sore Winners. He's also Fresh Air's critic at large. He writes a column on media and culture for LA Weekly. And in September, he returns to his position as film critic for Vogue magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, the debut collection by Carl Yanyema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, photographing David Bowie, Iggy Pop, Lou Reed, the Ramones, and Deborah Harry before they were stars. We talk with Mick Rock. His latest book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie.
I'll meet you. I will.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When David Bowie was transforming himself into his androgynous alter ego, Ziggy Stardust, Mick Rock was there to photograph him, helping to turn Bowie and Ziggy into icons. Rock became Bowie's official photographer and became an important part of England's glam rock scene. Then he moved to New York in 1977 in time to photograph the punk and new wave scenes. His photos are on the album covers of Lou Reed's Transformer and Coney Island Baby, Iggy and the Stooges' Raw Power, Queen's Queen II and Sheer Heart Attack, The Ramones' End of the Century, and Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll. More recently, his subjects have included Michael Stipe and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Rock's new book collects his photos of Blondie and its lead singer, Deborah Harry. It's called Picture This. On the cover is a photo of Deborah Harry that was first published on the cover of Penthouse.
They put it on the cover of Penthouse, clothed in black to her neck, which Debbie and I thought was very entertaining, in fact.
In addition to being clothed in black, she has a scarf around her neck.
Yes. There's a minimum amount of skin.
Which is very unusual for the cover of Penthouse. But what's happening on her face that makes this so erotic?
Ah, yes. Well, it's the face and the hands, of course, the whole and the shoulders. The whole body language is so highly charged. An interesting thing about Debbie, of course, is I don't think there's any pictures of there lurking about out there of her without any clothes on. I mean, I suppose when she was a bit younger, she was a Playboy bunny at the Playboy Club. But I don't think anybody's ever seen Debbie's naked breasts, unlike a lot of modern performers. So notwithstanding the fact that she's regarded probably as the sexiest lady that ever came out of rock and roll, she has done it all pretty fully clothed. I mean, short skirts in her youth, obviously, but that was about as saucy as she actually got. But the face, of course, is an unbelievable face.
Now, in your Deborah Harry book, you write, "I responded strongly to Debbie's libidinal pull. I knew that this was someone I could do some magic with photographically." What about David Bowie? Did you respond to his libidinal pull? And what did you relate to? What did you relate to about his like makeup and gender
blurring?
Well,
his androgynous thing. Well, you have to understand the spirit of the times, of course. This was abroad, the whole gay liberation. There was I had many gay and bisexual friends, and so I was, if you like, already inculcated into a certain sensibility. Because for me, these were people who were like outlaws. These were people who were exploring interesting terms, interesting realms aesthetically. So the androgynous thing was something that was part of the times, of which David was certainly the finest exemplar. So, but of course, that also embraced my dear friend Freddie Mercury and also Lou Reed and certain other characters at that time. Look at early Roxy Music.
When you were photographing David Bowie in his Ziggy Stardust years, were there things you tried to do with lighting or with camera angles that you thought helped to bring out both his female and male sides?
I think it was less to do with that than to do with the nature of my understanding of him. I did some pictures in April of 72. There are ones in the pink room which are quite well known. They're actually taken in his son's room at that time, his son's bedroom. And there's some pictures of him. There's a famous one of him in the mirror. And it all looks in a way kind of has a little pre-Raphaelite touch to it. And he said, when he viewed that session, he said to his manager, and his manager, I remember coming out of a meeting and repeating it to me, he said, Mick sees me. In fact, he's the first photographer to see me the way I see myself. So clearly there was a sensibility link between the two of us that was very strong from the beginning. So quite how it happened is hard to say. It's one of those interesting alchemical things, you know. It's this kind of like a plasma that oozes off the subject onto the film. But I think he has used, here in interviews I've seen him say, that Mick was very empathetic. So I think maybe that was key to what happened. He was able to allow himself to explore the androgynous thing. I think it was less in those early days about the lighting and the angles so much as the meeting of our sensibilities.
Did you help him create the Ziggy Stardust persona?
No. David Bowie created the Ziggy Stardust persona. I was an interpreter. I helped him get it over. I took a bunch of key images at a key time that helped transmit, that helped interpret that image. But absolutely not. Nobody created Ziggy Stardust but David Bowie.
Do you have a favorite photo of him that you took?
It's hard to say. There was a famous shot of him, which is actually a performance shot of him biting Mick Ronson's guitar. I mean, over an 18-month period, there are quite a few of them, but there's a particular black and white one of the first time he did it that was reproduced in an English full page in an English rock newspaper called Melody Maker that definitely helped get David over. It was like seeing Jimi Hendrix biting his guitar or setting it on fire or Pete Townsend smashing his guitar. It was one of those classic rock and roll moments, and of course it fulfilled the sense of androgyny that was in the air, because there was David Bowie apparently on his knees gnawing away on Mick Ronson's guitar. So it had a moment. It was like it's hard to imagine that anyone would be shocked by that today, but in those days, that was kind of shocking.
You photographed the Ramones, and you're right, when you first saw the Ramones, yeah, you thought they were very short on rock and roll sexual allure, which you considered a distinct drawback. You say they struck you
time,
as the least attractive band you had ever witnessed to that point.
Yes. I think that remained true. However, as time went on, I grew to love the music. I don't know that the way they look I ever found sexually alluring, and probably nobody did. Their strength really was their music, and of course they did have a distinctive look. They exemplified, if you like, American punk, which was not as fashionably sharp as English punk, as manifested by the Pistols or the Clash. But
no, the Ramones were t-shirts, jeans, and scraggly hair.
Torn jeans, of course. Yes, you had to be
leather
torn
jackets,
around the kneecap.
Leather jackets, yeah.
Yes, and Converse. But the music, you know, you have to give them the music. The music
absolutely
remains, sounds so fresh to this day. So, but when I first saw them, it was a bit like I'd been used to photographing very beautiful men, very androgynous men. And there were these four who were not, you know, I mean, the gayest person in the world wouldn't have gone home with any of them, probably. Maybe Dee Dee, you know? But that would have been about it.
And you never suggested that Dee Dee or Joey put on eye makeup or anything, too?
No, Dee Dee might have gone there. There's some interesting stories about Dee Dee out there, having been actually a bit of a male hustler in his youth. But that's a whole other tale, and not for me to tell.
Okay.
My guest is photographer Mick Rock. He's taken many image-making photos of such performers as David Bowie, Queen, Iggy Pop, Lou Reed, and Deborah Harry. His new book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie. It's called Picture This. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Photographer Mick Rock is my guest, and his new book collects his photos of Debbie Harry, and a previous book is called Blood and Glitter. Now, in your Blood and Glitter book, which was your glam rock collection of photos, David Bowie wrote the introduction, and I want to quote something he says in the introduction. I love this. He says, glam rock never made an impact on middle America to any extent. We were bookended by Alice and Kiss, butch manly glam with lots of guillotines and fireworks, muscle and metal. No mistaking the sexual bent of those fellas. Nothing ambiguous about our boys. That's the only way Ohio could accept lipstick on males. Do you agree with that perception?
I think so. I think David's very astute. I think David... It's interesting with David is he can be inside and outside something at the same time. I would say absolutely. I mean, Gene Simmons, with all the makeup on, I don't think anybody ever thought he was androgynous. And even Alice. And I love, believe you me, I love... I remember going with David in 72 at the high, just as Ziggy was taking off, and Alice Cooper was the biggest band in the world. And it was the... I remember him singing Dead Babies. What was it? The Killer album. It was great show, great theatrics, but not, even though, yeah, they were in makeup. I mean, I don't think anybody thought of them. I think it was theatre rock. It was clearly a very theatrical thing. It would be like, it's like Marilyn Manson, although I do believe he's a brilliant man, Marilyn. I don't think... his androgyny is in a certain way closer to Alice's than it ever was to David, because David was, let's face it, and remains to this day, a very beautiful man by any standards. But there was, in those days, let me let you into a little secret, is the truth of it was, in those days, is that boys that looked like girls got the hippest girls, and that was a fact. So don't think that this was a lot of poovery going on, although there was a certain amount. Believe you me, there was a lot of rabid heterosexual acts going on at that time, and the boys in makeup, and that would have included myself at times, although not as overt as some of my friends, were not left by the wayside when it came to hanging with the ladies. Let me let you in on a little secret.
No, but getting back to what you were saying, let's keep this to England, where you were at the time.
Yes.
Why do you think
although
that...
Although I did tour America with David, and I did tour America with Lou Reed that period too. So
why do you think that men in makeup were so appealing to women?
I think it was an outgrowth of the hippie thing. Again, remember everything, because the softening of the male. I mean, boys were growing their hair long. Now, today, a boy with long hair doesn't necessarily look effeminate or female. But I remember when my hair was starting to creep down below my ears, I would get wolf whistled all the time. So, you know, one got called puffs, I won't go and give us a kiss. All that stuff was going just on the basis of long hair, and not even hair that was that long. So one has to remember the times. And so that soft boy look had already been established as being heterosexually appealing. It wasn't. Then there was a bit of makeup, and then, you know, the clothes started getting a bit fancy, and then it was. And you also, the glam thing in England was also, if you like, known as decadent rock. The idea of all these boys looking like girls, and it was a very sexual period. It was very highly charged. It was a lot of makeup, a lot of dress up, and a lot of heterosexual sex going on. Of course, it was also the time of the emerging gay revolution. And so all these things were all tangled up together, all at the same time. And I was living the moment.
I imagine there were a lot of secrets you had to keep during that time. I mean, for instance, Freddie Mercury of Queen came out years later, but, you know...
People in the circle probably knew, but I don't
think they necessarily wanted record buyers to know it.
Oh, I don't know. I understand what you're saying, and maybe that is true of America. And let me not. I was touring in America, but I wasn't living here at that time. So, but Queen were called Queen. I mean, it was pretty clear that Freddie was
really
bisexual.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear that Freddie was bisexual. And when they came to me, they wanted pictures where they looked like girls. And frankly, the earliest pictures I shot of them, they looked like a bunch of very kissable schoolgirls, to be quite frank. So all of them, notwithstanding the fact that the other three are absolutely not gay at all. But Freddie was living with a lady. In fact, the lady who eventually he left his entire estate to, a lady called Mary, who remains a friend of mine to this day. And he was living with her when I first met him. But you've got to remember also the power of the amongst the young, and it's probably true today, but of course I'm not quite as young as I once was, but of being hip. So if androgyny was the hip moment, you wanted to be androgynous. And if the idea that you may or may not be bisexual was floating around, well, that was all good for pulling the girls anyway. So it's I mean, there's pictures of me and David out there somewhere. We would look like a couple of schoolgirls as well. So, you know, I admit that I was working that turf as not just in my subject matters, but also in the way I was presenting myself, but not as extreme as a David. David was a very special and a very theatrical case. David was steeped in theatre, remember, from an early age.
What kind of makeup did you like to wear?
Well, I used to always wear a little kohl under my eyes, but I was known at parties. There would be you get a little kohl, you get a little rouge, and a little lip gloss. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't overly powdered, but like some people I knew, but definitely I always wore kohl, and I if it was a party, I would be quite happy to slap it. I would have a little thing of lip gloss in my bag, you know, and of course I was married already. I was already married by about the age of, 21. So it wasn't clear. But no one quite knew. It was all so mixed. And it was also a time of great exploration. The whole sexual thing had popped way out of the closet thanks to the hippies. And this was a time, if you like, of consolidating all of that. And you've got to remember, this is also, you know, a pre-AIDS period. So I write in my introduction to the book, you know, everybody kissed everybody, held hands with everybody, and went home with everybody. And therein lies a truth, that there was a huge amount of sexual experimentation amongst a core constituency, mm-hmm, of the hip community at that moment in time. In fact, to indulge yourself sexually, and let's face it, we were young, we were not so sophisticated as we thought we were, was in and of itself a statement, a revolutionary statement, if you like. So the fact that it's different now, it's very, when you look back, one tends to look from the perspective of today, but if you lived in that moment, it was very exciting. There we were, upsetting people, and we were definitely in the upsetting. We're still trying to upset our parents. You know, we're still distinguishing ourselves from an earlier generation. Today, it's very different. It's not the same at all. You know, it's very hard to view it in the same way.
You write that you stopped taking drugs and stopped smoking after having bypass surgery in 1996.
Stimulants. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you ever try to do that before bypass? Like, did it take bypass to,
yes,
kind of force you to,
yes,
stop?
Uh-huh. Yes. To be candid, yes. It was God's way of straightening my arse out. I think there's no. And of course, the beauty of it is that creativity was something that I didn't have a problem with, but getting my life together, I did. However, it cleared me out. It was like when they cut me open, all the demons flew out. And after that, I became much more clear-headed. And I finally learned how to change gears so that life... Before that, I think, for me, the excitement that I got out of taking pictures, out of being around music, I wanted that to go on all the time. And whatever I was doing was an attempt to constantly maintain that excitement. What I learned after... as a result of a very painful experience, because, yes, I had bypass surgery, and some people, of course, recover quite quickly because it is... But me, I was also detoxing. So it was very painful, but I didn't... I actually handled it very, if you like, very well. I kind of knew at the time that this was the end game. I knew that this was it. But what it did was it allowed me, in a sense, to rebirth. And that's what has happened. Now, I can go into the head now. I can go to places where I used to go with a little chemical help without that help nowadays. But I, of course, I do a lot of yoga and massage and preparation. And I can go in. A little coffee helps, I will admit. So coffee or a Red Bull. So it's not that I'm entirely, if you like, clean. Although when I do, it's interesting, you know, because where if I have been on a run of interviews or working a lot, and then I take a little break with all the yoga I do, I detox. And what I'm detoxing for is the caffeine or the guarana or the taurine or all these, you know, more recently discovered stimulants. And I wish I'd known about it early. It would have saved me a lot of money.
My guest is photographer Mick Rock. His new book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie. We'll talk more about his photos of musicians after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest Mick Rock has taken many now famous photos of such musicians as David Bowie, Freddie Mercury, The Ramones, Iggy Pop, and Lou Reed. His new book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie. It's called Picture This. In your book, you quote Oscar Wilde as having said,
yes.
Beauty is the wonder of wonders. It is only the shallow people who do not judge by appearances. Do you think of yourself as beautiful?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Although I think I was lucky that I looked a certain way and in the wake of certain characters who come out of the music business, who, let's face it, if by any traditional standards, a Bob Dylan, a Keith Richards, a Mick Jagger would not be regarded as either necessarily good-looking or even sexy. Certainly in the 40s, you couldn't have given them the way. By the time I came along, in the wake of people like that, I had an appeal because I had a bit of an echo of these characters who'd been some way established in the hip sensibility of my generation as being attractive. So I traded off that. I don't think, so I just got lucky. And that's been, I have been a lucky boy in many ways, but then I've also been chastised well. So, and that was my near-death experience when I, because I was on the brink apparently. So I did go to the edge, but it was not a drug overdose. And certainly I was not deliberately self-destructive. I was just a constant experimenter who got caught up in my own mythology and, you know, and the con that comes with that.
Do you think of beauty now, having photographed so many really interesting rock stars, some of whom are just like born handsome or beautiful and others who kind of created their image, do you think of beauty as something that is physiological or something that you can just kind of create through force of personality or through design?
I think it's a combination of those two things. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're 5'2", 300 pounds, well, no, bald isn't necessarily a bad thing today, but maybe, and you know, and it, maybe it's harder to project that, but I do think it's a combination of things. Debbie Harry is beautiful as far as I'm concerned. She will tell you that she didn't particularly like the way, and she writes about it in the foreword to the book, she didn't particularly care for the way she looked when she was younger, and certainly she became more and more obviously beautiful. One of the things she did, of course, was to start dyeing her hair, and that really helped her. But it was obviously always there because look at the bone structure. But as her attitude evolved, I think she became what she became, which is absolutely unequivocally, just the greatest blonde that ever rocked, as I call her. So I do think there's loads of pretty people out there, but are pretty people necessarily beautiful? You know, no, not necessarily. They are pretty. Now, you can be pretty and beautiful. You can also be kind of off-center and beautiful. I mean, look at, again, take Keith Richards Keith just looks interesting nowadays, but you look back to him, you know, around the time of Altamont and that period. I mean, now you look at him, you go, wow, look at that. He kind of defined the beauty of the rock and roll look. Was Elvis beautiful? I think, yeah, Elvis was always beautiful, wasn't he? There was a moment in time when he was beyond beautiful. He was completely fabulous. I think as the mythology accretes around certain people, something happens to their sensibility, but something happens in the way people view them. You can, if you like, impose. She's not really that good looking, and if you see her in the flesh, you wouldn't take a lot of notice of her. But Madonna's someone who worked very hard at that. I don't think, because I remember meeting her before she was known at all, and frankly, she was plain, you know, but she learnt a lot of tricks. In fact, let's go back to someone like Marlene Dietrich or even Greta Garbo. You look at stuff, stills taken from early Greta Garbo pictures in the 20s in Sweden, or early films of Marlene Dietrich, even The Blue Angel, which was the one that put her on the map. She they were neither of them particularly attractive women. So they learned little tricks of makeup, and certainly Dietrich learned about lighting. And as their sense of themselves grew, so and their understanding of little tricks of makeup, of lighting, all this stuff, so they became much better looking. There is a word, photogenic, as well. Some people in the flesh look fabulous, and it's very difficult to get them on film. Some people in the flesh look, you know, fairly regularly. You get them on film and they're like magic. Some people look great in person and photograph like a dream. So, you know, it does depend on the individual.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Listen, I had a lot of fun. You've been a lot of fun to talk to.
Mick Rock, his new book collects his photos of Deborah Harry and Blondie. It's called Picture This. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Hurdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Hey, man, leave me alone, you know. Hey, man, well, Henry, get off the phone. I got the, hey, man, I got the straight on my face. This smell of that chick just put my spine out of place. Hey, man, my school is insane. Hey, man, my work's down. Total blam blam. She said she had to squeeze it, but she, and then she, oh, don't lean on me, man, 'cause you can't afford the ticket back from some wretched city. Oh, don't lean on me, man, 'cause you ain't got time to check it. No, my some wretched city was out of sight.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to presidential campaign ads from 1952 to 2004. We talk with David Schwartz of the American Museum of the Moving Image, which currently has an exhibition of campaign ads. And we talk with journalist Brooks Jackson, who is analyzing current campaign ads for factcheck.org. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.